From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the prophecies of Billy Meyer. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. It's time to go after ISIS in Iraq and Syria. President Barack Obama said that in a nationally televised address intended to sell stepped-up military efforts to a very war-weary public. Obama said the United States would expand its airstrikes against the Sunni jihadists in Iraq and to target them across the border in Syria. Let's check in with our Jerome Corsi, of course, writer for WND.com and noted author. First and foremost, Jerry, I've got to ask you your reaction to the president's speech tonight.
Well, I think, George, it's going to be judged on results. I mean, this is a strategy to go after ISIS, largely with airstrikes, with bombing, and with a very limited coalition so far. I think 9 countries have joined us, and under 500 troops on the ground. So the American people are going to look at this strategy and say, all right, let's implement it and see how far we get. If there's more beheadings of journalists from the Middle East on video, I think Obama's going to have to step up the strategy. But for the moment, I think the American public is going to say, let's give it a try and see what happens.
Can you really eradicate an organization like this, Jerry, merely by bombing?
It's going to be very difficult, George. And I think what the message President Obama was trying to communicate was that it's up to Iraq and possibly even some combination of Syria and the other Arab countries to eradicate ISIS, and that the United States will help, but that we're not going to do the job for the Middle East. And again, the strategy is going to be judged on how it works. I think the American people, which you properly point out, are weary of war, do not want to have another major involvement of an army fighting of U.S. soldiers in Iraq. So the American public is going to say, let's give this a try. But depending on how quickly there are results, if ISIS is beginning to be eliminated, I think the American public will stay with Barack Obama. If ISIS is in fact defiant and we have more beheadings on video, if ISIS is still very vibrant in the Middle East and threatening the United States, I think the American public are going to demand a step up in the effort, even if Barack Obama is reluctant to go to war.
Jerry, in the beginning of the Iraqi war, after the Iraqi soldiers merely took off their uniforms and put down their arms and ran away, then later on the insurgency started during about a year period, and they had beheadings of American journalists and Americans who went there and other people, and they put it on video, and they realized this is not a very smart public relations campaign. We better stop that. When does ISIS begin to realize what they're going to do is possibly wake up a sleeping giant, us?
It's a good question, Jordan. I think ISIS may be beyond caring. I mean, if ISIS is in a commanding position and feels it can get a control over Iraq and Syria to create this caliphate, I think the powers that be within ISIS are going to, and remember, ISIS has money. It's got oil money. Well-financed. It's a powerful organization drawing jihadists from around the world, including in the United States, to join ISIS. It's not going to be an easy enemy to defeat. And, George, within Iraq, I mean, you're right. I remember Fallujah and the bodies hanging from the bridge, you know, horrific sights in Iraq at the beginning of the war. And they were horrible public relations, you know, for the world to see, and supported George Bush in the war, seeing these horrors. But with our ISIS, you've got a different kind of enemy. You've got an ideologically driven enemy fighting Sunni Shiites, which is a conflict within Islam that's been going on virtually since the time of Prophet Muhammad. And so you've got a centuries-old conflict by a group of dedicated and very efficient killers in ISIS, and I don't think they're going to easily care about public relations as their first priority.
And one of the things we need to do too, Jerry, is set up, I think, an elite force to go after those people who are financing them. And I think we know who they are.
I think so too, George, but the problem is, you know, some of our allies, like in Qatar and in Saudi Arabia, may be in fact financing ISIS. because, again, you've got the Sunni-Shiite conflict, and you've got right. Iran in the wings. Ironically, if we defeat ISIS, we're benefiting Iran and ultimately Assad in Syria. And these are two very, you know, Iran is most likely proceeding to build a bomb and not complying with the negotiations that are supposed to be going on in Geneva. And we're entering on the side of the Sunnis, you know, to Iran's, to defeat the Sunnis, to go against the ISIS forces, which will benefit Assad and Iran. So it's a very complicated situation. But even the discussion tonight about arming the rebels in Syria, you know, identifying who exactly the rebels are in Syria and where ultimately their goals are is not easy. And they're not ultimately necessarily our friends. That's the problem with the Middle East. I've said this for decades and on the show, George, violence, while necessary sometimes in the Middle East, is not the solution ultimately to the problems of the Middle East. It's far too complicated. And we could end up with a larger and expanding war if we don't effectively get ISIS quickly.
I mean, there's no question, Jerry, that ISIS is attacking, maiming, butchering Christians throughout the Middle East. They are doing that. I'm not sure if they are a direct threat to the United States. Some people believe, you know, here we go again. It's another way for us to keep this going. They have no plans to ever even come over here. I don't know, but we do know one thing. They are truly butchering Christians all across the Middle East. That has to stop.
Well, there's a tragedy that's gone on in the Middle East since the Arab Spring, which was not the democratic movement it was promised to be. The Muslim Brotherhood took over through North Africa and began persecuting Christians. Today, the Middle East is a dangerous place for Christians. I can see a future for the Middle East, if it continues this way, where there won't be Christians able to survive safely in the Middle East. And, you know, for 2,000 years, Christians have thrived in the Middle East. That's a fundamental difference. And the ISIS forces are international. It's clear that there are people from the United States going to join ISIS. There are pockets within the United States, especially in Muslim communities in various states, where ISIS has favor among people residing in the United States. And, you know, the idea that we're not going to have additional terrorism here in the United States is one I hope and pray is the case, that we will not have terrorism. But I don't think it's necessarily the way to bet. Certainly Homeland Security is not going to take that for granted. Homeland Security, I think, will be on alert, as they should be, especially through the 9/11 anniversary.
Good point. Jerry, thank you so much for spending the time with us on a very important subject. The death toll from the worst Ebola outbreak in history has now jumped by almost 200 in a single day to at least 2,296 people. It already is its highest rate ever. The World Health Organization said it recorded 4,200 cases in five West African countries as of September 6th. More than 300 people a year just in the United Kingdom and Ireland report that they have been conscious during surgery, ouch, despite being given general anesthesia. In the largest study of its kind, scientists suggest this happens one in every 19,000 operations. They found episodes were more likely when women were given general anesthesia for cesarean sections or patients were given certain drugs. Experts say, though rare, much more needs to be done to prevent such cases, especially in those one in 19,000 cases who seem to wake up in the middle of an operation. A devil-worshipping group is deciding to host a satanic black mass, planning to go ahead with its controversial ceremony this month, despite protests by residents of Oklahoma City and a lawsuit from the Catholic Church. Let's check in with the genius, Howard Bloom, about this one. Howard, I got to ask you this. If religion is supposed to be free, why don't we just let them have the black mass?
Well, that's what we're doing. The church in Oklahoma City came down on them like a ton of bricks. It came down on them with a lawsuit. Now, contrast this with ISIS. Contrast this with the Sunnis and the Shiites. The Sunnis and the Shiites are killing each other. They're chopping off each other's heads. The ISIS is marching as many as 220 captive soldiers at a time into a field and then shooting them all, every single one of them. We have creative opposition in the United States. We have a balance of opposites. We have Republicans who face off against Democrats. They get highly emotional. Ann Coulter says some of the nastiest things you've ever heard in your life about liberals. Liberals say nasty things about Ann Coulter and the financiers of the Republican Party, but nobody kills anybody. So you've got a group. It's a very tiny little group. It calls itself Dacra Angra Mainyu. It has a leader named Adam Daniels. He is deliberately doing this black mass in order to get people's goat. He's deliberately doing it in order to upset people. Why? Because he calls it a war, and he says that his triumph in that war is headlines. And he claims that he's gotten headlines all over the world. Well, you and I are talking about what he's doing right now.
That's right.
But in reality, the modern Satanist church, which was founded in the 1960s by Simon LaVey, is nothing to be worried about. It is against harming children. It is against harming animals. It's simply in a world where often religious strictures are too structured and don't give you room to breathe. They don't give you room for the passions. They certainly don't give room for sexuality. The satanic church champions the sexual. It champions the passionate. But it doesn't do it with any greater damage to society than Republicans and Democrats do when they oppose each other. In fact, there's a certain healthiness to it because we do manage to take out the struggle between passions and structure. Two things we both need. We need them side by side, both passions and structure. But we work out this opposition in a totally peaceful way.
Well, in as much as I don't agree in a black mass by Satanists, Howard, they do and should have a right in their own way, in their own privacy, to be able to do what they want to do.
And they're doing it. They've sold out 88 tickets at $17.50, which is pathetic. That's tiny. They've sold out, though, but that's nothing. So,
that
yes, let them do what they want to do as long as they don't harm their fellow human beings.
HowardBloom.net, that's his website. Thank you so much, Howard. The iPhone 6 hasn't even been released yet, but there's already a way to get it for free. In an unusual move, Verizon Wireless has announced it'll give away the phones. The catch? Well, you have to turn in your old iPhone and sign a new two-year agreement with Verizon. In South Carolina, what a sad story. An elderly couple who had been together for more than 60 years found dead inside their home. What happened? The woman was dying. Her husband tried to give her CPR. She died. He died trying to give her CPR. Unbelievable. Up next, Stan Deo joins us. We'll be talking about the Garden of Eden. Did he find it? Find out next on Coast to Coast AM. Couple of major topics with Stan Deo tonight. Research physicist and author Stan Deo has worked undercover for the FBI as well as held a top secret security clearance. He took part in the exclusive Black Project, which specialized in flying saucer technology. His expertise is also earth changes and climate concerns. And here Stan Deo is back on Coast to Coast. Stan, always a pleasure.
Hey, good evening from the John Galt State, Colorado.
There is no Stan. Where might he be? Hello, Stanley. Are you with us?
Yes. Are you there?
There you are.
Ah, I don't know what happened there. Anyway, good evening from the John Galt State, Colorado.
Yeah, that's right. Who is John Galt anyway?
You bet.
Hey, I want to talk with you about a couple things. One, of course, is your work on the Garden of Eden. We'll do that a little bit later on tonight. But your thoughts on an expanding Earth theory. Unbelievable. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I started researching it some time back, a few years ago, and I got really serious about it here, back in May, June this year when I was going to give a public lecture. And I was trying to find out things in history that we could tie to a smaller Earth. And one of the things that really puzzled us, back then, was that dinosaurs are so heavy that they could not support their own weight on the bones that we've been able to dig up and analyze. And in fact, on the show images page I've got on our website at standale.com, show images, we link to a site that talks about this very problem about the dinosaurs, and it was just impossible for them under current gravity to walk around even. They couldn't support without breaking their legs and arms and stuff like that. So I thought, right, now the only way that I could see that they could walk around with all that weight would be if gravity weren't as strong.
Hmm.
Now, all right, so then I developed, I used some equations that we normally use in physics to measure the difference in gravity if the Earth were smaller and were spinning faster. And I put the equations up there on the website on that show images page so that people that want to check my work can do it. But basically what happens is when the Earth had a certain amount of energy in its spin, and it was smaller than it is now by 20%, it spun faster, and the day was like somewhere between 16 and 19 hours long instead of 24. And it tried to throw things off the planet, if you get my drift. The centrifugal force was opposite to gravity, and it neutralized two-thirds of the gravity. So in other words, the dinosaurs didn't weigh as much. They weighed one-third what they weigh now because of the smaller diameter Earth and the reduction in the force of gravity, the net reduction. Now, of course, when the planet did expand, the dinosaurs were in trouble, and everyone else weighed a bit more, too. The question became, when did this happen? Why did it happen?
And now, how big did it expand, Stan?
Well, we're now about, if you shrink us down 20% now, all of the edges of the continents will fit back together like a glove. If you don't shrink us down and try to put the continents together like the original landmass Pangaea, if you don't do that, when you squeeze the continents together, they have kind of an orange slice empty space between the edges because the Earth is too big to accommodate them. But if you squeeze it down just by 20%, you know, one-fifth of its, four-fifths of the current diameter, in other words, the continents all fit, the edges all fit perfectly. And, Dr. Owen's work and a number of other people have worked on this and have done much more learned, papers on this than I have, but they all agree that the Earth was smaller at some time. The question is, how long ago? Now, modern, accepted wisdom in physics and geophysics is that the Earth's continents were all together in one happy little piece called Pangaea, which formed about 300 million years ago and started to break up about 100 million years ago. Well, now that's fine. And, I thought, I can sort of live with that. I don't believe it, but fine. Then I started to think about over in Central America and North and South America, where they found clay pots and children's toys that were carved, which showed children playing with, dinosaurs, triceratops and that sort of stuff, with ridges down their back and fins. Now, how would they have known, even 1,000 years ago, what a dinosaur really looked like unless they saw him?
Good point.
Now, as long as I can stretch it back to the Olmecs, who were in Central America, even back that far, it was just a couple thousand years, they still had access to what a dinosaur looked like. So I thought, now if the dinosaurs couldn't walk, if they were too heavy and gravity was crunching them, but they could walk when gravity was less, then gravity got increased somewhere in, say, the last 4,000 or 5,000 years.
That's it?
Well,
wow.
But think about it. Think about it. How else could they be walking around and even flying, those leathery winged flying dinosaurs? There's about 10 different kinds. But how could they have functioned if, in truth, the Earth wasn't smaller and gravity was greatly reduced when humans were running around with them? And I remember, I've laid down in the footprint path over in Glen Rose, Texas, in where the dinosaur footprints are, right next to it, cast in stone, is a path of human being, adult male, going right along with the dinosaur.
Now, done at the same time, basically.
Yeah. So, this created a real problem in my mind. That is such contrast to established radiocarbon-14 dating and other methods of dating with gases, argon, and various other things like that. And then I started to look up how we date these things. And I found about 15 different methods of ways to date the Earth, and no two of them agreed. They were way out. Obviously the biblical thing says 6,000 years from the Garden of Eden. and that's just from the Garden of Eden. I don't know what happened before that, but anywhere from that point to, you know, 100 million years, and this is a big gap.
Now, is the planet Stance still expanding?
Well, you know, it might be starting to do it again.
Hold it. Hold that thought. Let's come right back and talk about that and get into your thoughts about where the Garden of Eden just might be next. Back with Stan Dale. So, Stan, is the planet expanding? And if it is, will that create all kinds of catastrophes for us?
You know, George, I think it is. And it's not doing it rapidly if it is. You know all these sinkholes that we've been hearing about all over the world?
Yes, all over the place.
And down in southern, well, the eastern side of the Baja, in Hermosillo, in Mexico, they had that, about two-thirds of a mile long...
crack. It's crack. Like a big crack. Yeah,
about 25 feet deep. Well, that occurred, but it occurred over where there was an underground stream that had weakened the ground. And if you go back and look at all these... sinkholes, and even the one over Louisiana, the Coin Bayou, all of these had to do with water underneath. A lot of them in Florida, water underneath eroding away the soil. But in majority of the cases where man has built structures over it, it has been over a water line, a pipe that is broken, actually pulled apart. Now, what would cause the pipes to pull apart unless we were seeing an expansion of the dirt? Why didn't this happen 50 years ago, 100 years ago? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's a current event, and it's all these potholes, even though you can attribute them to water erosion, they are the result of water erosion from a new spring or from a broken pipe. And that, you know, when you look at that, it says the earth must be expanding like a balloon very slowly and pulling things apart. Now, this can also trigger more earthquakes, more volcanoes.
That's
and
right.
Surprise, surprise, in the North Atlantic. From the western side of the Mediterranean at the Rock of Gibraltar, there's a fissure, or like a tectonic plate board going out from there and hit the Atlantic Ridge and going up into Iceland. And you know what's happening in Iceland at the moment. That's right on the ridge, and it's tearing apart. And it's not just one volcano. It's two, possibly three, and it is erupting now along a long fissure. So all these things add up to me to say that we're starting to see another expansion. I think these things periodically occur, but haven't for a long time, obviously.
Can it expand to a point, Stan, where the planet basically just rips itself apart?
Well, hey, when it was originally 20% smaller, then everything was together in one landmass, and then it expanded, and it ripped your Pangaea apart.
It did rip it apart. That's true.
Now, why did it do this? Is this a normal function of a planet aging and a star aging? And there's certainly a lot of argument that supports that theory or hypothesis, because stars expand and explode and become, you know, nova and that kind of stuff as they age. Now, planets, I'm pretty certain from studying like Mars and even Moon itself and moons of Jupiter, they have the same kind of evidence that we have on the surface of the Earth, that the landmass was smaller and has expanded at some point in time. Is it expanding now out there? I don't know. But the Pangaea breakup, they said, occurred around 100 million years ago. It started. There was also a major meteor impact in the Gulf of Mexico called the Chicxulub, which occurred, at their best guess, maybe 66 million years ago.
That's supposed to be the dinosaur killer, right?
Yeah, there's arguments about that one way or the other. You know, I think it probably had a lot to do with it. And the thing is, that is close enough by their best guesstimate to when Pangaea broke up that I think it may have been associated with the breakup, because if you look at a map of the gravity of the planet, you can get that at NASA. In fact, I've got the map on my website there on that show images page. If people go to standale.com and then click on the show images link by the microphone, the first thing you'll see is a picture of the gravity map of the Earth. And it shows something rather peculiar. It shows very weak gravity starting at the Gulf of Mexico, where the Chicxulub meteor hit, going eastward out into where, well, the Bermuda Triangle. And then it's strong all the way across to the Indian Ocean. And when you look at the Indian Ocean, it's a huge, the weakest spot on the Earth for gravity. Now, if the Chicxulub meteor hit at an angle and didn't go straight for the core, it could have definitely sent a shockwave over to where India used to connect to Africa and created a bulge, boom, like that, and shoved India up to make the Himalaya Mountains and part of the mountains of western Iran. Now, that's why we have seashells and stuff on the top of the Himalaya Mountains, because they used to be lower and had sea flowing over them before the impact. And I think that these two are associated, even though, you know, technically speaking, there's 34 million years between the dating of Pangaea breakup and that impact. They're very close. And this then led me to another rather amazing discovery, which I think is going to tie modern geophysics dating to biblical dating, which I didn't expect, but it is there.
Could that be tied into the flood?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The flood, we've been able to date that mathematically by the tilt and the axis of the earth, running it backwards to when it was vertical before it precessed to this angle. And we found that the date that whatever caused the tilt occurred was 2345 B.C. And that would have been the time of the flood, right in that same period, or that same year. And within 200 years of that, according to other evidence that we'll talk about in a minute with this Garden of Eden tale, the earth broke up. Pangaea split apart and started to spread rapidly. It wasn't like inches per year like it's doing now. It was a rapid separation. So anyway, I'll kind of get to that when we talk about the Garden of Eden here in a minute. But
sure,
all these things started to tie together. I called Holly downstairs. I said, Holly, you're not going to believe this. You know that Garden of Eden stuff? I mean, look. I showed her the evidence I'm going to tell you in a minute, and she just sat there and she said, look at the goosebumps on my arm. I can't believe it. It's real. I said, yeah, there really was a Garden of Eden, and we can find it with this information here. So I put the earth all back together again, you know, in the Pangaea thing, and as best we could from all the different opinions of how it fit together, and started looking for riverbeds. Riverbeds that weren't like little tiny streams, but they were real rivers, like, you know, the Amazon in South Africa, you know, with over 60 million gallons a second coming out into the sea from it. That river exists now, and that's like 12 times the discharge you get out of the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico there. But anyway, the thing is that the smaller Earth would have supported much longer rivers, much bigger rivers, because gravity was less. But anyway, I did find one place where water came from on Pangaea, the high spot, and it's part of the Great East African Rift today. And from there, I used Google Earth, and I went out to California there. I rang him up, and I said at the Scripps Institute, look, I know you guys are working on a very accurate plot of the depth and the patterns in the oceans, you know, bathymetry. Could I possibly have that to put into my Google Earth so I could have a look? And they said, sure. And so they gave me it before they released it, 2 months before they released it to Google, and said, look, here, go ahead and try it out. So I did. And boy, did I find the four rivers or what? Wow. wow. Anyway, it took a lot of disciplines, knowing a bit of Hebrew, being able to retranslate some of the old Hebrew and the physics and all that to get together to find the Garden of Eden, and I actually did, and you can see it today. You can go and walk there today. The walls of it are still up.
And, of course, the biblical account of the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve were there, is that conceivable?
Not only is it conceivable, in the place where it is, once you see the proof of it, we're getting the DVDs from the lecture I gave, and it'll probably be first week of October before it's released to the public. But our film crew is now going to go down to Africa, where it is, in December, and film the garden in 3D. But they're also going to be looking and filming some other proofs of that being the Garden of Eden. One of them is that it grows the quinine fig tree, which makes a leaf 10 inches long by 2 inches wide, and that's what you can sew together. It's like leather. You can sew together to make your, like a girdle or a skirt or something like that to hide your nakedness, just like the Bible said Adam and Eve did before they got kicked out. And when they got kicked out of the garden, when God took them out, he gave them animal skins. But while they were in the garden, they had to have access to a fig tree, and it grows while they're in the Garden of Eden where it is today. Now, I had to correct a lot of things in the English version of the Bible, the King James Version, because they did their best to translate and locate places that they could at the time. But they made one mistake on the second river coming out of Eden. It's called the Gihon in Hebrew. And so they say that river goes around the whole land of Ethiopia. Well, when you get into the Hebrew, it does not say Ethiopia. It says Cush with a K. And I had to find two Cushes, one that became Ethiopia, and the other is where Nimrod built the Tower of Babel over in southwestern Iran. And I did that by checking the names. And you can do this. You can go into Google Earth and look for names of places, cities, suburbs, counties, rivers that start with K, like Kish, Kosh, Cush, descendants from the group that Nimrod was from. That he didn't go with the rest of his crowd, of his family, over to Africa. He stayed and built, a mighty army and conquered people in that area from the descendants of Shem. But anyway, that led me to look for this mystery river, not in Ethiopia, but over in either a part of Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and near all of India. And I finally...
Great discovery.
Oh, well, I did find it. It was around India before it separated in that Pangaea model when everything's together. The River Gihon went around the entire country. In fact, you can see the footprint of it in the ocean. Very, very distinct. And I'm going to make that file available to you on a CD-ROM with everything that I used to find a garden. You can just plug it into your Google Earth, and you'll be able to fly over and see everything, every river, every little rock that I went over a zillion times to prove this. But you will be able to see it when I get that finished in October.
What does it look like now, Stan, the Garden of Eden?
Oh, well. If you'll go to the Show Images page and click on the top row, the third image, I have a couple of pictures there from my lecture, which show you what it looks like from a satellite and from an elevation model. And you can see it from satellite. You'll see 1, 2, 3, 4... possibly 5 volcanoes surrounding a collapsed volcano, which collapsed a long time ago before the Garden of Eden. And this collapsed volcano was as tall as Kilimanjaro, which is close to there. It was over 19,000 feet tall, and it collapsed and fell into a hole there. And when it did, it left a perfect 102-square-mile circle, a crater, with walls all around it that are still there today.
That's huge.
It's only... the only one in the world that exists today where the rim is still intact even. And the water supply for it, I thought, okay, here we are in an old volcanic crater. I said, how can anything grow there? And then I started investigating, where does the water come from for this volcano? And it comes from about 24 different water springs that gush, well, they used to gush up a lot more, but they gush up water up on the top part of what I call Eden, the main reservoir part, and it flowed down into the garden to water it. But the rest of it, the huge portion of it, went to form 4 mighty rivers that went one around India, one over through the mountains of western Iran and down east of Asher, which is Assyria and in the old days. And I found the Euphrates. It's one of the rivers, the fourth one. It was the hardest one to find because it was broken up into pieces. And I had to use that Scripps Institute bathymetry map, and before that became available, we couldn't have seen it. But it was the biggest surprise of all. But anyway, that does show us where the Garden of Eden is. If you look at that image I've got there on the Show Images page, and I show one of the geysers or the springs up on the top part that punches out water even today, but it punched out a lot more then, and grooved holes in the surface of the earth around there that you just would not believe until you get in there and have a look at it.
But does this discovery, Stan, alter or change your thoughts on the Adam and Eve story?
No, it underlines it. I believe it now. Oh, look, right next to this Garden of Eden thing here, and believe me, it is there. There is no question about it. When I investigated on the internet to see what was in that area, okay, it's in Tanzania, in the northern part, which used to be called Tanganyika, in the middle of about 42 volcanoes area. It's, hot stones around there. But on the top edge of the Garden of Eden, or the Eden complex, is a volcano, the only one of its kind still active on the world. And the volcano is called Oldoino Lingai, means the mountain of God in the local native language. When you get up on top of it. You can actually camp on it because it erupts slowly, oozing magma out. And you can film it at night and get the red glow of it. But it's half the temperature of any other volcano in the world. It's only about 500 degrees centigrade. And it oozes up the magma, and it cools. It's black, cools, and then cracks and collapses into a white dust. And 17% of that dust is what you get in Alka-Seltzer. It's kind of God's joke on Earth, I think.
Interesting.
Giving you Alka-Seltzer for the pain. But anyway.
Yeah, really.
And I found out that the local native tribe that had been there the longest, longer than the Maasai, they say that crater is called Ngorongoro, N-G-O-R-O, Ngorongoro. That crater was where God made man, and then God went up into the sky and didn't come back. Now, that's their legend, right? That's a paraphrasing of their legend. So, and they call that mountain, all the tribes, the Mountain of God on the top part of it. And understandably, it's called a Natron volcano. It's a very unusual, the only one of its kind in the world. And the Lake Victoria, which is kind of west of the Garden of Eden there, has a huge amount of water. And during the time when the Earth was smaller, the way the Earth was watered was by geysers, like, you know, Yellowstone, and by, springs, you know, gushing the water up from the internal pressure in the planet. And it tells you that in the Hebrew as well. So all these things add together, and one of them, particular, is a word that they mistranslated about the water, the river coming out of the land of Eden to water the garden. It doesn't come flowing over the ground. The word says it gushes up like the limbs of a tree into the air and falls back. And
it's a geyser. It's like a geyser.
Absolutely. I mean, when you correct these little tiny details, you start to find it. And I had, you know, somebody say, well, yeah, well, where were these big guards and stuff with the flaming sword to turn in every which direction to guard the Garden of Eden so the man couldn't get back in? And where were these cherubs, you know, these guardians? And I say, well, if you look at what the word meant in the old Hebrew, it means they were big, powerful things, and the spinning sword with flame and everything, it also meant in the old dialect, it meant spinning, sparkling fire. And it was volcanoes that guarded the way, and it didn't guard the way, it lit the way to the Garden of Eden. And it just tells you, it marked the path so that when generations would come later, they'd know the Garden of Eden was there. And
where did we lose the knowledge of the Garden of Eden? Because, you know, here we have a researcher like you picks up on it thousands of years later. What happened in between?
You know, I think that this was kind of kept at high levels of government in any country that knew about it. I do think that Solomon, King Solomon, did know where it was for a variety of reasons, but he looked at the descriptions of these rivers that came out of the Garden of Eden, and one of them went around a country that was known for its gold. It was called Havilah. And, you know, he had a lot of gold. He got it from three main places, and one of them was a place called Ophir next to Havilah. And Havilah used to join with Ophir, which is today called Madagascar Island, and that used to connect to western India in the Karnataka district, which, you know, all those have gold in them, but southern Tanzania, right up to the Kilimanjaro, right outside the Garden of Eden, had gold. Now, I think that if Solomon knew, in fact, I know that he knew, and he described where Ophir was in code. And Ophir, it kind of means like a wedge in some of the ancient language of Solomon's time. And in those days, when they wanted to split a stone, they would take, you know, a stone and cut a little groove in it and hammer a piece of wood wedge into it, cut another one, and we can finish that after the break.
Okay, Stan, good. We'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.